Welcome to Chapter 5, where we start our long journey with regard to stocks. Sexy stocks, exciting stocks, risky stocks. And in this chapter, we have, what should we call it, an introduction to stocks and the stock market and different types of transactions, how do we buy them, and different types of companies, some measurements, and strategies. So let's get started. We start with a quote from a humorist from the early part of the 20th century, Will Rogers. He said, "Don't gamble. Take all your savings and buy some good stock and hold it till it goes up. And if it don't go up, don't buy it." Yeah. His generation was scarred by the crash of 1929, and for 40 years after that, people were just turned off to the idea of investing in stocks. Generations were harmed by the crash of 29. Slide number 2. What are stocks, and where does the term common stocks come from? You see, when people talk about stocks, they're almost always exclusively talking about common stocks. And the term comes from, 400 years ago, when these corporations were first created in the Netherlands and the UK, and the investors were shareholders in common. So the term is common stock, not because it's just plain old everyday stock. And every shareholder received one vote for every share that they owned. And obviously, if you owned 50% plus one of the shares, you're basically in charge of the corporation. Stocks represent ownership in the corporation. And we call stocks equity financing. Yeah, that's equity is another word for ownership. This enables the investors to participate in the profits and growth generated by the business enterprise. But unlike a sole proprietorship or a partnership, the shareholders, the stockholders, are limited liability owners, which means you can only lose your investment. They can't come after you if the corporation still has debts outstanding and can't pay them, and the corporation is basically bankrupt. Now, there are some ways that people have tried to use the corporations as a veil, as a way to hide from liabilities. And such, there are ways for the courts and the authorities to pierce the corporate veil, as it's called. But in all the cases that we're discussing, bona fide companies, that is not going to be an issue. And you'll learn more about that in Business 120, Introduction to Business. So, what do stockholders receive, huh? Well, stockholders receive dividends, which are optional payments of earnings, which are distributed to the shareholders as the company prospers. And capital gains, also called capital appreciation or capital losses, because as the corporation does well, if the company does well, invests well, makes good products, goes into new markets, innovates, the value of the corporation rises and so the stock rises. Now, are either of these guaranteed? No. Right? So stocks are risky. Contrary to what many believe and how many behave, stocks are not simply millions upon millions of worthless pieces of paper that people trade each day for no reason. Well, they're not even pieces of paper anymore. It's all electronic, right? No, they represent ownership in real businesses. Now, are there people who trade millions and millions of these things back and forth for no apparent reason? Yes, but they're not investors. They're traders, they're speculators. And if you want to be a speculator or a trader, I wish you all the luck in the world, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to help you that much. I certainly can't do it. Slide number 3, historical performance. How have they done over the long term? Well, we tend to use the 19-teens, 1920s as a benchmark to start with. There were stocks, obviously, way before that, but there's a reason why we do that. We often call it modern finance, and there's some various historical reasons that we don't need to get into, but let's use the last 80, 90 years. The stock market has returned, as measured by the Standard & Poor's 500, which, by the way, in our next presentation, we will actually take a look at in detail. We've already discussed it in Chapter 4. Has averaged around 10, 11%. Remember I tell people 8, 9, 10%? But in any one year, it's unlikely that it's actually going to be 10 or 11%. It happens, but no, it's usually far from that. The return has varied from a high of 53.8% to a low of -43.4% in 2008 was one of the worst years on record, -38.5%. So, in any given year, there's been a 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 chance of a down market. So does it go 1, 2, 3 up and then down? No, it doesn't work that way, right? For example, the great run-up from 1982 to 2000, stocks just kept going up and up and up and up and up, and everyone said, no, they're never going to go down, and then they went down 3 years in a row, 2000, 2001, and 2002. So you can't predict what's going to happen the next year. You can look at history and say, well, there's a probability that this is going to happen, and you may be right, and you may not be right. Slide number 4. Here is the graph that we took a look at back in Chapter 1. And again, I want you to ignore small company stocks for the most part. I mean, realize that they, yes, they do better than large company stocks over the long term, but they're far more volatile, and there is a tremendous survivorship bias, meaning that we don't always count the ones that went down the porcelain oasis. But sure enough, if we have a long-term perspective, stocks have clobbered bonds and short-term investments as measured by treasury bills, bank accounts and the like, savings accounts, and then we've all beaten inflation, thankfully. But still, what would you rather be invested in over the long term? My preference is stocks. Is it a guarantee? No. But folks, if the whole thing falls apart, you know, if the system fails and stocks underperform over the long term, then it's only a matter of time before the rest of them fall down, because then we'll all be digging for beetle grubs and boiling bark for dinner. Slide number 5. This graph is a little more subtle and tricky than the previous. But it's a great graph, folks, because it shows you rolling 10-year periods. This is the Dow Jones Industrial Average, by the way, which is similar to the S&P 500, which we'll discuss in detail in the next presentation. But if we go back to 1928, we see that coming out of the Great Depression, those 10-year periods, stocks returned negative amounts over 10 years, which is a pretty good long time, 10 years. But here we come out of the Great Depression, out of World War II, and boy, weren't the 1950s and the 1960s a great time to invest until 1970s came along. What happened there? Well, there was a lot of turmoil in the 60s and 70s, culturally, but also economically. Why? Mostly because of the baby boom generation. If you are a student of demographics, you know that the baby boom generation was this huge, they call it the pig in the python event, where our economy had to swallow this huge amount of people growing up and wanting jobs and refrigerators and cars and housing. And it was a very difficult time for the economy. And sure enough, we see that the 10-year period, it just barely hit. I think it was 66 to 76, zero. It didn't go negative, but it was not good. But then here we come out of that time, And we have globalization and internet technology, computer technology, and the go-go 80s and 90s, and we're going to get rich, 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 and then what happened? Right, the internet bubble, we got hit by, and then we got hit by the housing bubble, and sure enough, we have the Great Recession. And we have to go back to the Great Depression to see times when 10-year periods for the stock market were negative, but it does happen. And here we come. Look what's happening. Ah, now, is this cycle going to repeat itself all over again? I don't know. I don't think so. Doesn't mean I'm right. Doesn't mean I'm wrong. But I truly believe, personally, and take it for what it's worth, folks, because I'm not... I'm the professor we call ourselves professors, we're really instructors, at a lowly community college. But I firmly believe that the next 20, 30 years should be the most prosperous years in the history of the world. Why? Because of globalization. Because more than half now, never happened in the history of the world. More than half of the world's population now, not much more, but just more than half of the world's population are considered what is called middle class. Now, again, if you compare them to the United States, it's not a fair comparison. But workers around the world are making more money. And when they do, when they have more cash in their pockets, what do they want? They want to buy the things that we take for granted. You have a hard time trying to get your kids to brush their teeth at night, right? Well, Crest and Colgate, and they're having a hard time getting a billion people in India to brush their teeth for the first time. But once they see the benefits, exactly, so you see, Coca-Cola and Marlboro and all these, Dan and Yogurt, all these, Nestle, all these brands and products that we take for granted are being introduced to huge new markets. We could blow ourselves up. Ebola could be all the rage. A meteorite could come. You never know. But I'm optimistic. And I'm invested accordingly. Slide number 6. Historical performance continued. Traditionally, close to half of the return from stocks was from reinvested dividends. You see, two big things why we like stocks, dividends and capital gains. People concentrate on the capital gains, but dividends are very important. And stockholders used to expect 4-6% in dividends each year. That was as much or sometimes more than what bonds returned in interest, since stocks were considered much riskier than bonds. So we go back between 1936 and 2008, we find that the S&P 500 dividend average was 3.8%. Now, that's skewed lower because some of the companies in the S&P 500 at any one time are always growth-oriented companies which don't pay any dividends, right? So, yeah, so you see, that's a hard average to knock high when you have companies that don't pay anything. But throughout the 80s and 90s, dividends fell precipitously to less than 2% at the peak in March of 2000. The S&P 500 was paying 1%. So why? Well, there were various reasons, but people wanted capital gains. People wanted growth. So the dividend average from 1997 to 2007 was 1.5%. And here were some of the reasons. Dividends were taxed at a higher rate than capital gains. Well, not anymore, so that's out the window. People wanted the business to reinvest the earnings for growth instead of distributing it to the investors. Yeah, sure, they don't pay me dividends. I want you to turn around and make this company huge. Stocks were no longer considered riskier than bonds. Well, we learned that that wasn't true, didn't we? Savings accounts were also paying less than 2%, so here you go, compare it to a savings account. And then people lost track of their senses and bid up the prices. And certainly there was a lot of that with regard to the internet and technology companies in the late 90s. So here is a graph on slide number 7 showing the yield on bonds versus the yield on stocks. And we're going way back to 1960. And we find that, Yeah, stocks returned less, but not much less than bonds. And then we see a divergence. We see bond yields start to rise precipitously because of the 1970s and all the baby boomers wanting refrigerators and houses and shoes, and inflation started to kick in. And so bond investors are saying, whoa, inflation is your worst enemy if you're a bond investor. So you're demanding high yields. And then we see the yield on stocks going up. Why? Because people were dumping stocks, bidding the prices down, so the yields go up, as we'll see when we learn to calculate the yield on a stock. And then in late 1970s, the gentleman by the name of Paul Volcker, who's still around, folks, a Republican, was nominated to be the Federal Reserve chairperson by Jimmy Carter. Yes, we did have a president named Jimmy, who was a Democrat. And Mr. Volcker told the president that, I'm going to break the bracket of inflation, Mr. President, but it might cost you your presidency in your reelection campaign in 1980. But to Mr. Carter's credit, he said, you know, you do what you have to do. And they jacked interest rates up in the short term. I think once it hit 22%, the prime rate there for a bit. Mortgages, some of you weren't even around, but mortgages hit 17% just for a very short period of time. And that broke the back of inflation, and then we see the yields on bonds starting to fall and fall and fall. And stocks doing well in the 1980s and 1990s, and the yield on stocks starting to fall and fall and fall. Until 2000, when the yield on the S&P 500 hit 1%. And then whammo, right? We got hit with the internet bubble collapsing. And then bonds continued to fall and fall. And then what happened? The housing bubble and the subsequent bursting and the bursting of the bond market. Exactly. Now, this is a 10-year treasury bond, folks. And what we see in 2008 is we see the yield on stocks, because stocks plummeted, going higher than the yield on the 10-year Treasury bond, because people flew into Treasuries and the Federal Reserve Bank knocked down interest rates. And boy, wasn't that a great time to buy stocks. And then we've seen them seesaw back and forth. And whenever the yield on bonds has been less than stocks, it's usually been a pretty darn good time to buy stocks. Now, what happened, this is December 31st, of 2013, what happened? Well, the 10-year bond has taken a bit of a spike upward throughout the end of the 2013. Stocks did pretty well, so we see that the yield going down. But just this last month, January was a really tough month for 2014, that's reversed a bit. The yield on 10-year treasuries I wouldn't use the word inch, it's sort of dropped down to 3.6 or so, 2.6. It hit 3% at the end of the year, and the yield on stocks has gone back up as stocks have taken a bit of a hit. But what do you think, huh? Are bond yields going to go back up to historical averages of 4, 5, 6%? Are stock yields going to stay low? Well, we'll see. Slide number 8. The pendulum swings. The bear markets of 2000 to 2002 and 2008, have changed investors' perception about dividends. We now see investors and companies focusing more and more attention on dividends. Many companies that never paid dividends in the past are doing so now. For example, many tech companies, they're no longer growth stocks, they're mature industries, and some of them are sitting on tons of cash. So what are you going to do with it? For a while there, Apple was sitting on $160 billion. Microsoft was sitting on $60 or $70 billion in cash. How many times can they rewrite Windows? I mean, they keep rewriting it and they keep making it worse. The tax law has also changed so the dividends are taxed roughly the same as capital gains. And there's a great quote from a woman. She actually wrote a book called Dividends Don't Lie. She's based here in La Jolla. She might have passed away, I'm not sure. The book's not that great, but I love the line, dividends don't lie, folks. That is the one number you know the corporation is telling you the truth about. Why? Because they sent you a check. Now, they don't send you a check anymore. It's electronically deposited into your account. But whatever. That money came out of their pocket and went into your pocket. So dividends don't lie. And this quote is attributed to John Rockefeller. We don't really know if he said it or not, but it's a great quote. Do you know the only thing that gives me pleasure? It's to see my dividends coming. Exactly. Dividends don't lie. I like dividends. I hope you will come to appreciate them too. Slide number 9. So let's quickly review what are some of the pros and what are some of the cons of stock ownership. Well, some of the advantages are that they allow the general public to share in the rewards of business enterprises. So you drink Coca-Cola, you can be part owner of Coke. You wear Nike shoes, you can be part owner of Nike. And in his book, One Up on Wall Street, Peter Lynch, he plays up this theme. And that's a book that you really do want to read. Hopefully it's one of the first books you read. You've heard of books, right? Well, there's a bibliography on the website you want to take a look at, the commentary. They have had the best financial, I should use the word financial investment returns over time. There are some people who will jump up and down and say, real estate does better, and, don't get me wrong, I like real estate, but over time, stocks have done better than them, but you could say that real estate's done better because of the way you invest in real estate as opposed to the way you invest in stocks. Yes, we can debate that later on. How about liquidity? Stocks in general, providing they are real companies, bona fide companies, as the saying goes, easy to buy, easy to sell. Somebody wants to buy your shares. Somebody wants to sell you some shares. And we talked about the limited liability. But there's one advantage that we don't normally talk about, and that's this system, this capitalist system, has been probably the worst economic system the humans have ever created, except for all the others. Exactly. When something better comes along, you know, it's not perfect. Nothing humans have ever created is perfect. When something better comes along, sure, you know, we'll take a look and see if it really does pass the test of time. But this system, more than any others, has increased the standard of living for everyone. Now, that's the problem. It has not increased the standard of living for some the way it's increased the standard of living for others. So there's that inequality that every once in a while makes it into the news and makes it into the culture. And currently right now there's talk about the income inequality, the wealth inequality, and that is something that must be addressed, and hopefully we will, in a cool and logical... No, forget it. We'll be screaming at one another and nothing will be done in a logical and a responsible way. And then what are some of the disadvantages? Well, we said it. They're risky. They're volatile, which is a fancy way of saying you can lose your money, and you will lose money if you invest in stocks in the short term. In the long term, we'll see. Should do okay. No guarantees. And then, of course, there's all the corporate and financial industry hanky-panky, trucos, travesuras. Yeah, I can't find a really good translation to Spanish for hanky-panky, but my understanding is that travesuras and trucos sort of work. Yeah, that's where the money is. Slide number 10. Volatility examined. Here's the Standard & Poor's 500 for the year 2013. And in reality, folks, 2013 was one of the less volatile years. But still, it was sometimes when you thought the world was going to end anytime soon, because right out of the gate, 2013, a little bit down here, a little bit down here, but that wasn't bad, and then a little bit down here, and then up, and then, oh no, the summer's coming, sell in May and go away. We'll discuss that one later on. But did you hang on? Sure you hung on, because here it comes back up, and then, oh no, it's falling again, there's like, and then it comes up, and it falls again, and then, whew! So what's going on? This year was tremendous. It just went up and straight up, but didn't go, I mean, up and way up, but it didn't go straight up. So what did you do? You sat on the sidelines waiting for it to have a significant pullback, and there's the pullback, and so you thought, okay, time to put my money in. So maybe you put your money in and wrote it up here, and then it started to pull back, and then, now it's really going down. So you pulled your money out here only to see it jump up here, and then you put it back in, and then when it ran down, you see, you have to be prepared for the bumps, because there's going to be bumps. And if you're trying to time when those bumps are going to be, all I can say is good luck, really, because nobody can do it except by liars. It can only be done by liars. No, I didn't. That's not my quote. That's a very famous quote by a gentleman by the name of Bernard Baruch. Don't try to time the market. It can only be done by liars. And they're lying to themselves, I think, more than anybody else. And of course, they're lying to the people they say who they say they can do it. And some of them probably know they're lying, but a lot of them, I think, are just, they're just fooling themselves. Yeah. Slide number 11. Now, we're going to spend some time, and chapter 5 goes into great detail about this, discussing the different markets, the primary and then what is called the secondary market. In the book, they go into far too much detail about the primary market. In general, folks, we retail investors should just stay away from the primary market. Maybe a little bit of your money, but if the secondary market is where we are going to invest in. So again, the book goes into far too much detail. If you take the Series 7 exam, you are going to have to learn all that stuff in the book in Chapter 5 and then some about primary markets, even though you probably won't be selling any of these things to your clients, but maybe you will. So slide number 11. The primary market is the market in which new issues of securities are sold to the public. It is called an IPO, initial public offering. Going public, taking the company public. There is a... There is a methodology that corporations have to abide by to go public. As I said, stay away from the public market. It's not for the faint of heart. IPO doesn't stand for initial public offering. It stands for it's probably overpriced or imaginary profits only. The secondary market is the market in which securities are traded after they've been issued to the public. The vast majority of transactions that we see take place in the secondary market. So let's go to slide number 12. Why should a company go public? Why would a corporation issue stock? Well, there are many reasons. To raise money to start or expand a business. We've got this great idea. We need $150 million. Let's see if we can get the public to bankroll it. If we have a company that's already an established company and we need more money, we could go back to the secondary market to help pay for ongoing business expense. I'm sorry, back to the primary market to help pay for ongoing business expenses. This is what many of the biotech companies here in San Diego do. They burn through cash. It's called their burn rate. Because they need $500 million or $800 million to get that drug approved. Eesh. And they're not making any money, so they have to sell stock to do it. As a way to gain prestige and respect within the investment and industrial communities, once a company gets large enough, it is just expected that they will become public. Now, some companies decide not to. Or they say they're already public. They're public and they say, the marketplace isn't respecting us. We're going to go private. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. But what are some of the largest private companies? One of the ones that is one of the largest is the company that makes the most popular candy bar in the United States. You know which one it is? Right. Snickers. Right. It's Mars, M&M's. That's a private company. Now, you can invest in Hershey's. But you can't invest in Mars because it's privately held. And when these companies go public, typically, the folks who started the business become instant multimillionaires in some cases, multi-billionaires. Why? Because now, exactly. Now it's a public corporation. You were one of the people who got in on the ground floor. And so you're excited. You want to start a new company and take it public and make $1 million or $1 billion. But for everyone, Google, right? Do you any remember Lycos or AltaVista or Go or Ask Jeeves or Dogpile? Right. For everyone, Farcebook. There's lots of MySpace books. I don't know what they're called anyway. Que Pasa is another one. And once a company gets large enough, how do you divvy up the spoils? How do you sell off pieces? How do the owners sell off pieces without going public? Think if you were one of the people who started GE or Coca-Cola or Walmart. How would you sell your share of the business? The marketplace, the going public, allows for that ability to sell off pieces of the company, a large company. Slide number 13. The corporation does not have to repay the money. You've sold a piece of yourself, and now you are under no obligation to repurchase the shares. And the shareholder may or may not be able to find someone who will purchase the shares from them. But if it's a bona fide, a real company, yeah, there's going to be somebody out there who wants a piece of the action. But now, once the company is public, once it is now a public corporation, it now has many rights and responsibilities that private companies just do not need to worry about. If you go to Mars and say, how much money did you make last year? How much cash is on your balance sheet? What are your assets? What are your liabilities? They'll say, excuse me, who are you? But if you go to Hershey, they'll say, oh, go look at our 10-Ks and 10-Qs, our annual and quarterly reports that we have to file with the Securities Exchange Commission under penalty of perjury. Exactly. So now you are a public entity. You have responsibilities. You must have at least one public meeting annually. And SDG&E is a great example of some companies that said, okay, we'll get you. They're based here in San Diego. And for a while there, they were making some pretty boneheaded maneuvers. So every year at the annual meeting, shareholders would come and jump and scream and holler. And they said, all right, we'll have our annual meeting this year in London. You want to jump and scream and holler at us? You got to fly to London to do it. Chapter 5 goes into much detail about IPOs. But, folks, the truth is that most IPOs do not usually live up to the expectation. The typical IPO loses 50% of its value in 1 year. And Benjamin Graham likes to say, I already threw the jokes at you, IPO stands for it's probably overpriced, or imaginary profits only. Okay, slide number 14. All right, let's get serious, because most of us are going to be dealing with the secondary market. These are the markets in which securities are sold after they've been issued. You might hear some people say it, the aftermarket. I don't hear it that often. Secondary markets provide liquidity, as we said, an easy method for transferring ownership of securities, and a very normally efficient mechanism, not always, for pricing and valuing securities. So if you have 100 shares of IBM, you can go on call your broker or go on your computer and say, oh, they're selling for about this much. This is how much it's worth. And you can tell your bank, hey, you know, I got this as an asset and the like. When people talk about the stock market, they are almost always referring to the secondary market. Okay. Slide 15. Traditionally, there were two types of secondary markets. Organized securities exchanges, and then the OTC, the over-the-counter market. But, folks, this is an outdated comparison. Due to technology advancements, mergers, acquisitions, the traditional differences between the two have all but been erased. The changes are just getting started. See, you've heard the Securities and Exchange Commission. Exactly. That was created before there was an OTC, but it was nothing. But now it's gotten huge. So the exchanges, these are centralized locations, centralized institutions in which transactions were made in outstanding securities made in public corporations. And they used what was called the double auction market. It was a face-to-face way of making transactions. No more, folks. I mean, there's a tiny little bit that's going on, but no. The OTC market was a widely scattered telecommunications network through transactions were made in outstanding securities, public corporations, and smaller initial public offerings. And when they said telecommunications many years ago, it was a telephone network. You'd call up your friend, maybe not a friend, you'd call up Fred in Minneapolis and say, "Hey, Fred, you got 100 shares of Butterfly.com? And of course, there weren't any .coms at the time, but you got 100 shares of Flim Flam Incorporated? And Fred said, "Yeah, I'll sell you. How much? $25. Steady! Hang up the phone and call somebody else. And these people would take lessons in how to be rude to one another. But not anymore. It's all online. It's all, quote, based online. And nobody picking up the phone and calling one another. So the differences have been all but erased. Let's take a look at slide number 16. For the exchanges, historically, all trading was conducted on the floor. And trading was conducted using a double auction system. You're familiar with the one seller, multiple buyers that you see in an estate or farm auction? And the guy going, no, that's not the way it was on the exchange floor. There are multiple sellers, multiple buyers, people calling out prices and making hand gestures and yelling and screaming at one another all at the same time. But due to both technology and the sheer massive volume of shares traded, this is gone. There's still a little bit that goes on, but it's all done electronically, folks. They're not yelling at one another. They're sitting at a terminal all typing in numbers and seeing the best price they can get. Some large trades still involve some human interaction, but no, it's far less than 1%. I think the only reason they keep the floor there is for television. That's the only reason they keep people on the floor. It's just to show something on the nightly news. Slide 17. And who was the granddaddy of all the stock exchanges? The New York Stock Exchange, the NYSE, the big board. Traditionally, it was responsible for over 90% of the volume of transactions on all the exchanges. It's about 2,800 companies with about $18 trillion of market capitalization. Way back in 1792, it was called the Buttonwood Agreement. This is for you trivia fans. It was established as a members-only entity when Wall Street really was next to a wall. It actually wasn't the first stock exchange in the United States. Philadelphia created one in 1790, 2 years before that. Companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange must meet stringent requirements. They are the largest and most prestigious companies, or at least traditionally they used to be. And if your company, fails to meet the stringent requirements, you can get kicked out. You can say, "Sorry, you don't belong to our club anymore." And by the way, it wasn't until 1966, I think, that the first woman was a member of the New York Stock Exchange. I think that's the right name. Look it up for me, folks. This was the venerable New York Stock Exchange, where any company that was a real company was on the New York Stock Exchange. But, folks, there have been huge changes, and these are just some of the most recent ones. In 2005, they purchased the Archipelago Electronic Exchange. What's that? We'll just see that in a few slides. And the Pacific Regional Exchange. That was the exchange based in Los Angeles and San Francisco. Figure that out, because all exchanges are supposed to be centralized locations, but the Pacific Exchange is based in L.A. and San Francisco at the same time. Yeah. They became a publicly traded corporation. No more members only. No, it was a publicly traded corporation in March of 2006 when they merged with an electronic exchange based in Europe, the Euronext, and they phased out the face-to-face double auction trading in favor of almost exclusively trading electronically. I should probably throw the word in there almost, because there's still a little bit of trading that's done face-to-face. And then in 2011, Germany's stock market, the Börse, I can't say it right, tried to purchase the New York Stock Exchange, but was blocked not by the feds of the United States, but by the European regulators. And then last year, the New York Stock Exchange was sold to a 13-year-old derivative trading firm from Atlanta. What? A company that didn't even exist until the year 2001, I think it was, 2000 or 2001, buys a company that's over 200 years old and was the, you know, the where it was at. In 1992, on their 200th birthday, which they made a big splash of, if you had told the folks at the New York Stock Exchange that the next 20 years would see far more changes than in their first 200 years combined, they probably would have thought that you were quite insane. But as I said, the changes are just starting to get started. Slide number 19. On traditionally the floor of the exchange were house brokers who executed orders on behalf of their firm's customers and occasionally on behalf of the firm's own account. There were also independent brokers, sometimes called $2 brokers, because that's what they wanted for their work. They wanted $2. It was a long time ago. And the floor traders were very worried that the New York Stock Exchange's aggressive moves to all electronic trading would mean the end of their way of life. It was not really the end, folks. It was just a big change from face-to-face interaction to sitting in front of a computer terminal screen all day. And what I want to ask you, dear students, is does this sound familiar to you? What are we doing right now? I'm sitting in front of a computer giving the presentation. You're sitting in front of some mobile device or a computer listening or watching and listening to the presentation. Yeah, the technology is changing our lives. And so, you know, it's not the end of their way of life. It just means that they're not going to be screaming and hollering and yelling at one another. They're going to be typing things into a computer and seeing what kind of buy and sell orders they can get. Yeah, exactly, exactly. Technology. Slide number 20. The specialists. Dun, dun, dun. Well, they've become less and less important. The specialists on the stock exchange were stock exchange members who specialized in making transactions in one or more stocks. The job of the specialists, we should say, was to manage the auction process. They bought and sold, and they still do, but they're just not as important as they used to be, a stock from their own inventory to provide a continuous, fair, and orderly market. Their job was to get in there and buy when nobody else was buying and get in there and sell when nobody else was selling. The role of the specialist is being squeezed out by technology and the tremendous volume of trading. They are becoming less and less involved in the typical trading day. They were actually replaced in 2009 by what are called designated market makers and supplementary liquidity providers. And if you can understand the big difference between the two, you're a better person than I, because I can't really figure out what the difference is. They both look the same to me, but check it out if you are so inclined. And throughout the years, from time to time, the specialists were either praised or maligned. Suffice to say, if the specialists are trying to make a profit, just like everybody else, while their goal may seem altruistic, everybody else is selling, they buy, everybody else is buying, they sell, they make sure that when the market receives benefit from their efforts, so do they, or should we say, so did they, because they're just not as important anymore. There's a great story about that comes from a gangster by the name of Lucky Luciano. I make sure I got it right. Look it up. And he is supposedly to have given a quote that is still relevant to today. He was shown the New York Stock Exchange and the role of the specialists and what they do. And he said, "Oh no!" This is after he had been, you know, in trouble and supposedly was being deported. And said, "Oh no! I made a terrible mistake. I joined the wrong mob." Exactly. Slide number 21. For many years, the kid on the block, the little kid, the little big little brother, the much smaller cousin or whatever you want to call him, was the American Exchange, the Amex, the American Stock Exchange, which used to be called the Curb. Where'd that name come from? Well, folks, they literally started on the curb outside the New York Stock Exchange. Right. Yeah, so the way they called it the Curb. They eventually got their own building down the street. But it's now called the NYSE MKT. Micket? Market? I don't know. I can't understand what's going on. It's much smaller than the New York Stock Exchange. Traditionally, only 3% of the volume, and they saw the handwriting on the wall over 20 years ago. They started concentrating on securities other than stocks. You see, remember the ETFs in Chapter 4? That's where the ETF started. They started on the Amex. Well, in 1998, NASDAQ bought them. Who are they? We'll look at them in a few moments. And then kicked them to the curb, again, got rid of them in 2004. And then in 2008, the New York Stock Exchange bought them, moved them down the street into the same building, and changed the name to the NYSE MICKET. Uh-huh. Goodbye, American Exchange. New York Stock Exchange Market. I guess that's what, I don't know, MKT. And then there were, they still are, but they're nowhere near as powerful. They never really, really were very powerful. The New York Stock Exchange or the Amex. And these were the regional exchanges. All told, they only accounted for 4% of the volume. Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, the Pacific Exchange, which we said was actually two places, Denver, Cincinnati. The Denver Exchange was one of the ones that was definitely where the where companies that really weren't real companies were often based. Many of the securities listed on the regional exchanges are also available on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ. Traditionally, they were places where undesirable or unethical issues were sold, the Denver Exchange being one of the worst. Lately, the regional exchanges have tried to diversify and differentiate themselves from the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ just in order to survive. Plus, for example, the Philadelphia Exchange started to specialize in semiconductor companies and in chip companies. Plus, the regional exchanges have not been immune to the rush to consolidate. The New York Stock Exchange bought the Philadelphia Exchange, and the NASDAQ bought, the New York Stock Exchange bought the Pacific Exchange, which we already said a few slides ago, and the NASDAQ, which we'll discuss in a few slides, they bought the Philadelphia Exchange, the urge to merge. So, small players. Options and futures. Now, we just touched on them just for a moment, and we'll touch on them again for a moment, but all you have to know in this slide is that they had their own exchanges, and they were based in Chicago. And the Chicago Board Options Exchange, the Chicago Board of Trade dealt with options and futures, and these are those derivatives that derive their value from other assets that we will come back to in detail later on. But suffice to say that now the options are not only traded in Chicago, they're also traded on the New York Stock Exchange and on the NASDAQ, so everybody's getting in to everybody else's cookie jar. They're getting their hands in everybody else's cookie jar. Slide number 24. So now we turn our attention away from the exchanges, which were traditionally centralized locations, but not so much anymore, to the over-the-counter market. As we said, they are widely scattered telecommunication networks through which transactions of securities are made. There's no single location, and people often refer to them as just OTC, over-the-counter. They are quote-based systems as opposed to the traditional double auction on the exchange floors where people are screaming and yelling and yelling out buy and sell orders. Here, people are just typing them into a computer. Remember, they used to call each other up and try to make deals on the phone, but that doesn't happen anymore. It's all done electronically. And there are three tiers. The NASDAQ, which we'll discuss in detail, is the National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotation System. Folks, you don't have to remember that because they don't even use that acronym anymore. They just call themselves the NASDAQ, and it's all uppercase. They do not want to be associated with the OTC. If you call, if you talk to somebody from the NASDAQ and say, oh, you're a member of the OTC, they go, no, we're not. We've divorced. We have nothing to do with an OTC. Why? Because the other two main players in the OTC, the bulletin board and the markets group, the OTC markets group, are places where, literally, folks, bogus companies exist. I mean, some of them are companies that are falling on bad times or never quite got off the ground, but most of these companies are just scams. This is the wrong side of the tracks, folks. The red light district, right? The wrong side of town, the bad side of town. But the OTC Markets Group used to be called the Pink Sheets. And where did they get that name? Because they would publish these newspapers with all the different listings, and they used pink paper, so they called them the Pink Sheets. And it looks as they just changed their name to OTC Markets Group, and it looks like they're trying to clean up their act. They've been kicking off hundreds of companies that have in the past been involved in scams. And I assume they've gone to the Securities Exchange Commission. I don't know for sure, but I assume they've gone and said, hey, you know, we want to clean up our act. Can you help us? Who are the companies that you're getting the most complaints from about you know, bogus transactions and the like? And so we'll see. We'll see what happens. I mean, it shows you how much stuff is changing. Eesh. So, slide 25. The role of dealers in the OTC. Dealers are traders who make markets by offering to buy or sell certain securities at stated prices. They are also called market makers. The dealers offer buy and sell quotes from their own inventory of stocks, whereas brokers simply serve as a go-between between buyers and sellers. They keep no inventory. In general, but there are some brokerage firms that act as dealers, so it can get a little confusing. But these dealers, these market makers, perform roughly the same role as the specialist in the New York Stock Exchange. They have what is called an ask price. Now, you can think of that as the retail price, and I know it's sometimes hard to remember. And then they have a bid price, the wholesale price. You have to learn these, folks. The ask price, and if you get, one way to remember it is if you have to ask for it, it's more expensive, right? You know, if you have to ask how much it costs, it's too expensive. So the ask price is always going to be higher than the bid price. And the difference between the two is the spread. That's how the dealers, the market makers, make their money. They make their money on the difference between the bid and the ask prices. Whereas a broker is going to charge you a commission, the dealer, the market maker, is going to make their money on the difference. Make sense? Yeah, the ask price is what you have to pay. The bid price is what you're going to get. And this should look somewhat familiar to some of you. Slide 26. Unlike brokers who charge a commission, dealers make money from the spread of the bid and the ask prices. Just as the Casas de Cambio in San Ysidro and Tijuana make money on the differences between the prices in which they buy and sell pesos and dollars. And there will be a little presentation as I go down and take some pictures in San Ysidro and Tijuana, and you'll see the difference in the competition and how they make their money. The dealer's markup and the dealer's markdowns are not reported to the customers, whereas the broker's commissions are reported. And so how do you think the internet brokers actually make money on a $5 trade or a $7 trade? Well, we'll discuss that later on. How do they make money? Well, they get a kickback, some of them, from the dealers. Yeah. Slide 27. Finally, we get to the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ started in 1971 as the first electronic communications network. The organization that started it was called the National Association of Securities Dealers, the NASD. This is a non-governmental organization that used to be responsible for the self-regulation of the stockbrokers and the brokerage industry in general. But they are no longer in that business anymore. They have given up that business and changed their name to just NASDAQ. They don't want you to even remember that NASDAQ stood for National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotation System. Nobody used, well, at least they don't use it anymore. They just refer to themselves as the NASDAQ now. And they, obviously, they were making a whole lot more money from the NASDAQ than they were from being the NASD. They provide up-to-date and bid and ask prices on about 2,800 stocks. They used to be the arena for small companies to get started. But once the companies became large enough, the idea was they would move to the New York Stock Exchange. Well, since the 1980s, many prestigious companies decided that, thank you very much, we're very happy on the NASDAQ, and we're not moving to the New York Stock Exchange. And some of these companies you may have heard of, Microsoft, Intel, Apple, exactly, eBay, Google, yeah, New York Stock Exchange, now used to be the only game in town for huge companies, and you can just here are the two words that they said at the New York Stock Exchange, the first one being oh, exactly. Now it's a two-horse race, and these two entities are fighting it out amongst one another. Slide number 28. The NASDAQ, even though I don't think most people even know this, but it's a three-tiered system. The Global Select, Creme de la Creme, these are companies that would easily qualify for the New York Stock Exchange. The Global Market, about 565 larger companies, which used to be called the national market, but now it's called the global market. And then the capital market, which used to be called the small cap market, which are about 600 smaller companies. The NASDAQ in the 1990s began positioning itself as the securities market of the future. You see what they're saying is, like, hey, we're the future. The New York Stock Exchange is the past. As it became apparent that the traditional face-to-face double auction model, where people were screaming and hollering and pushing one another and making hand gestures at one another, was not adequate to keep up with the massive increase of trading. Notice that the NASDAQ market capitalization is roughly $6 trillion. So it's still smaller than the New York Stock Exchange, but in general, the amount of transactions going on are comparable. Yeah. So it's a two-horse race, folks. There are alternative trading systems. There existed an upstart called the third market. And these were over-the-counter transactions, so there was no centralized location, made in securities that were on the New York Stock Exchange, Amex, and then eventually the NASDAQ. But these alternative trading systems were only for institutional investors, mutual fund companies, insurance companies, pension plans, entities that traded huge numbers, not 100 shares, but 100,000 shares. And the idea was that you would be able to get much reduced transaction costs because you were being matched with other entities like mutual funds and pension plans that had huge quantities that they wanted to buy. So if you wanted to sell a huge quantity, the dealer in the third market would find you somebody who wanted to buy those securities. And the big one was called Intermarket. There were others, but notice that it's now called the NASDAQ, you see, NASDAQ bottom, right? Exactly. And then the fourth market was the same idea, except they got rid of dealers. You could think of it like eBay, where there's no me in between. You deal directly with the buyer and the seller. So this is the same idea, large institutional buyers, but get rid of bypass the dealers, get rid of the dealers. And they started to be called ECNs, electronic communication networks. With the advent of the internet and the advent of technology and the tremendous opportunities that the communication systems created, they started to court the retail customer. So yeah, sure, you don't have to sell 100,000 shares. You don't have to sell 100. And what happened? Right, the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ, they jumped up and said, you know, we're not going to miss out on this. And one of the big ones there was called Archipelago. Notice it's bought by the New York Stock Exchange. Now it's called Nest New York Stock Exchange Arca. And another one of these groups is called BATS. What are these people thinking? It stands for Better Alternative Trading System. And folks, these people are based in a strip mall in Kansas City. I kid you not. I think it used to be a shopping center. And think about it. The technology has allowed companies to just say, well, we don't have to be anywhere near New York. You know how expensive it is to do business in New York? We could be in a strip mall in Kansas City, and I think they have around 10 or 12% of the pie, 10 or 12% of the trading in any one day. By the way, they had an initial public offering that they themselves ran, and it was a disaster. They really messed up, so look them up if you're so inclined. Wow! What a mess! Everybody's getting into everybody else's cookie jar, and the world is changing so darn fast, we can't even keep up with it. For example, I only learned about the New York Stock Exchange MICET by just looking up a stock. Nobody ever contacted me. I'm a broker. I called up my boss at the brokerage firm and said, did anybody tell you that the New York Stock Exchange had bought the Amex and changed their name? He said, no. I mean, this kind of thing 20, 30, 40 years ago would have been huge news. Now they don't even bother to tell the brokers. They don't care. It's, you know, not important. You go online, you don't see anybody. You just type in your orders, and you're done. Nobody came up. There was no big splash in the media that the pink sheets were now called the OTC markets. Eesh. Slide 31. Okay, Pino. Let's get down to some real questions. I mean, I know I got to learn all these different exchanges and know what they are, but isn't the stock market all just one big malignant casino? Come on, fess up. Well, you have to be truthful, folks. You have to acknowledge that there are people who treat the market as a casino. But then there are others that don't. It is a system that is used by people differently. So we could say the answer is yes, it is a malignant casino, and we can say that the answer is no, it is not a malignant casino. And how do we do that? Well, for the people who see the markets as one big crapshoot, they believe the way to riches is to buy and sell, buy and sell. It is very difficult. You are up against the best in the business. Neophytes become very upset when the market turns against them and then just say, this is one big casino. We call these people speculators. We call these people traders. The other group are investors. For them, the answer is no. The capital markets are a way for you to participate in the growth and the prosperity of the global economy. And with a long-term orientation, investors are usually very well rewarded, but as we will say over and over again, they ain't no guarantees. And this quote from The Intelligent Investor, a book that you will eventually read, don't read it first because it's pretty rough, but is just says it all, folks. An investment operation is one which, upon thorough analysis, promises safety of principal and an adequate return. Operations not meeting these requirements are speculative. Yeah, Mr. Graham doesn't pull any punches. Are you a trader, a speculator, or are you an investor? Slide 32. Oh, yeah, but what about Enron, huh? Some of you don't even remember Enron. It was 12, 13 years ago. But aren't corporations all crooks? Well, dear students, fraud and accounting, trickery and gimmicks have always been with us. They are always going to be with us. The great quote attributed to a bank robber, Willie Sutton, although he didn't actually say it, was because that's where the money is. Hey, this is where the money is, and that's why there's going to be crooks. Normally, but not always, those firms are relegated to the nether reaches of the OTC bulletin board, the pink sheets, which is now called OTC Markets, which is hopefully cleaning up their act. But for every one Enron, folks, there are hundreds, no, thousands of companies that continue to do business with integrity and honesty, well, usually. 40 years ago, folks, it was equity funding. An insurance company, and insurance companies just do not go bankrupt unless they do what equity funding did. These people just got in a room and made up your insurance policies. These are made up names. They, yeah, they crashed and burned. 25 years ago, it was Ivan Boesky and Vagabond Inns and Michael Milken, and they made the movie Wall Street after him. 5 years ago, it was Fannie, Freddie, Lehman, Citi, WaMu, and AIG, and don't forget Bernie Madoff. 20 years from now, during the next big bull craze, someone else will take their place. But that doesn't mean you should be scared away from the system just because of the crooks. They're always going to be there. They're always going to be with us. So, slide number 33. To recap, the securities markets exist to allow investors a safe, cost-effective method to participate in the success of the global economy, and even with all the underhanded shenanigans, they have performed very well. They are changing at breakneck speed, and the change is only accelerating. Whether or not we ever have a global or one or more global 24-hour trading markets remains to be seen, but it's exciting and for some of us scary to watch, especially for those of us who have a stake in the outcome. So go back over this study. You need to know these things. When we come back, we will take a look at different types of transactions and finally discuss in detail the stock market indices and indexes and averages such as this Standard & Poor's 500 that we've already discussed quite a bit about. Sorry. See you next time.